Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants since 1985, offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Late yesterday afternoon, the Major League Baseball Players Association announced that the players and the owners had agreed on a provision for unscheduled steroid testing and that the union would respond to the owners' most recent proposal regarding revenue sharing and a luxury tax during today's talks. These developments, among others, have led many observers to feel that the strike set for next Friday can be avoided. While many regarded the establishment of a strike deadline by the players as a dire development, at least one sports columnist, Ray Ratto of the San Francisco Chronicle and ESPN.com, had begged for such a development, accusing the players of, quote, torturous foreplay. Mr. Ratto joins me now from his home near San Francisco. Welcome to Only a Game.
Well, how are you, Bill?
Very well, thank you, and I hope the same is true of you.
I cannot complain. Well, I can complain, and I will later, but for now I'm going to play it down the middle.
We'll look forward to it.
Okay.
Early last week, you called for a strike date. Do you think the establishment of the deadline has been responsible for the alleged progress this week?
I think it helped prod things along a little bit. I think, you know, developments were going to play out as they were, but I thought that a strike date would help because I didn't think the sides were so far apart that it would only exacerbate things. I think it would remind them that, you know, look, nobody wants to see this one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody's got the stomach for it, not the owners, not the players. Here's your deadline. Now get it done. I think it was almost like a term paper for a college student.
Yeah, another writer I spoke to last week said, hey, deadlines are my friend. Man, I don't get the work done until I got one.
Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, I never got the sense that anybody other than a couple of ideologues on the owner's side really wanted this to happen.
It's a little bit hard to tell whether you regard the owners or the players as the bad guys this time around. You refer to both the owners and the players' union head, Donald Fehr, as, quote, ferret-faced gas bags. Have you a preference for one ferret-faced gas bag over another?
Oh, Fehr by a long shot. the only thing that irritates me about Don Fehr is that he really makes public appearances only to tell you nothing. And to me, you know, if you're not going to say anything, come out and say, I'm not going to say anything, and then let it go at that. Don't give me 45 minutes of not saying anything and pretend like that's helpful. But I always side with the players because, A, the owners have never proven that they've lost money. They can trot out a blue ribbon panel with books that nobody else can see. They're the ones who want the concessions. And where I live, if you need to borrow $1,000 from somebody, they're entitled to know why you need it. And they're entitled to find out if you're really telling the truth when you say you need it. And if you can't do that, you don't get the money. Adding to that, the owners, you know, historical, you know, ability to lie as easily as the rest of us breathe. My bias is clearly toward the players.
It sounds like you've got some baseball fans running around in there.
I have one.
That's one.
He's not really a baseball fan right now. He's basically convincing aliens to blow up Cowboys. But hey, it's a game for everybody.
His time will come, I'm sure. The owners and the players have apparently agreed to raise the minimum salary of a major league player. That's one of the things that they have agreed on. It's been written many times, but I wonder how many fans understand how many players never get much beyond the point of the minimum salary, the average major league career being about two seasons.
Exactly. The Alex Rodriguez contract blinds many people to the very limited shelf life a player has and the very few players that ever get to cash in. You know, a lot of people like to talk about the financial risks that owners run by operating a baseball team, but a player's risks are, if anything, greater because they're risking their bodies. If an owner goes broke, he can always amass another fortune. If a player blows out his knee and can no longer run again, well, he can't make another knee and be a Major League Baseball player. You know, the enormous salaries skew everything upward, but it's good to remind us that a year ago, Sean Wooten, who was a backup catcher for the Angels, was making $1,500 over the minimum of $200,000. I can only imagine what kind of bargaining between agent and general manager that must have produced.
The prospect of a strike hanging over this season already obviously has upset a lot of fans. That's been evident from the signs turning up at various ballparks, most of them insulting the players. If the owners and the players do reach an agreement and avoid a strike, does this resentment instantly disappear?
A lot of it does. I mean, the real visceral anger right now will dissipate because I think most people regarded a strike this time as an insult from both sides. You know, at a time when, you know, the economy is sort of in the dumper, when, you know, the memories of 9/11 are still relatively fresh. Petty greed really wasn't playing well on either side. And I think, you know, both sides came to recognize that, you know, rather late in the game, I admit, but they did.
You know, it strikes me that you're talking about your son in the background, I assume, son, blowing up aliens with cowboys, or was it cowboys with aliens? It seems like a fairly appropriate metaphor for what's been going on with baseball this season.
No. I mean, the one thing that struck me while everybody was getting particularly hysterical about this strike, the last one was far more acrimonious and bitter, and it was far clearer, far quicker, that there was going to be no meeting of the minds. That was really about the owners trying to get Don Fehr on a spit.
Mm-hmm.
This one was more sort of, it seemed to me, more nuts and bolts economic. There were not as many real ideologues. And I think it helped in some ways calm down the ideology that Bud Selig has maneuvered himself into, this inescapable trap of being sort of America's punchline.
Ray Ratto is a columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he also writes for ESPN.com. Ray, thank you for speaking with me.
Oh, not at all. It was great fun.
Yeah, I figure I'm not going to say that I'm going to boycott baseball for the rest of my life, but if they go on strike for a couple weeks, the rest of the season's gone, then I'll strike for a year.
That's Edward Nocello, a Mets fan from Farmingdale, New York. Obviously, he's thought about his response to a baseball strike, and in making his decision, he's considered the limitations placed upon him by baseball's hold on his soul. The same can be said of fellow Mets fan Mike Stutzman.
I'll inevitably come back to Shea as a fan. I'm addicted. I'm in it for life, more or less, and I don't hope they don't hear me saying this because they'll raise the ticket price into the $10, but yeah, I'll come back.
Lest any players or lords of baseball hear that and get complacent, there's no reason to conclude that Mike Stutzman is a representative fan. Consider, for example, the point of view of Shane Glavin, a fan of the Kansas City Royals, interviewed recently outside Royals Stadium. He still recalls how empty his life felt when the 94 baseball season ended without benefit of a champion.
It kind of seemed like you missed something in the fall. There was no World Series, and kind of discouraged by it all. And I really feel like I just got Chiefs season tickets, and if it wasn't for my wife, I wouldn't even come out here anymore. So I kind of feel like if they had a strike right now, I hear people say that they wouldn't come back, but I wouldn't, really wouldn't.
Alerted to the irony that he has the same name as one of the players most closely identified with the strike strategy, Atlanta Braves pitcher and National League player representative Tom Glavin, Shane Glavin righteously denied any blood connection.
I'd probably smack him around if I was related to him. I mean, anybody who makes that much money, it's ridiculous. And, you know, we were calculating, I'm an accountant, and we were calculating how much some of these ball players make. It's like, I guess Mike Sweeney, when he's been injured, he's making $50,000-$60,000 a game that he's missing, and it takes us 2 years to make that. So it kind of, they're way out in left field. I guess it's kind of typical baseball term. They're in left field. Every one of them, they're in left field. They're clueless.
That's an opinion apparently shared by other fans of the currently hapless Royals, where 37-year-old Paul Higdon, for one, is concerned that a strike might hurt most the clubs that are least likely to successfully absorb the economic hit.
Well, we're in big trouble in Kansas City if there's another strike, because their attendance has never been the same here since the last strike. And, I mean, attendance this year is already way down. And I would just hate to see the consequences of this and other small markets. You know, if there were a strike, I was just in Minneapolis and saw the Royals play the Twins last weekend. And, I mean, that team's going to the playoffs. And it was a Friday night, and there were still only 25,000 people there. And I just don't think baseball can absorb another strike.
Elsewhere as well, there are baseball fans who feel as if the patience of the rooting community is not infinite. Vince Opper, a St. Louis Cardinals fan, proved to be among that number when it was pointed out to him that despite the gloomy prognostication following the 94 strike, many fans returned once baseball began again.
Well, yeah, but I mean, this would be three within 20 years, and I don't know, you're not going to have another home run chase unless they rejuice the ball up or rejuice the players, whatever they're doing with it. I think it would be devastating.
Actually, the work stoppages total 9 in 30 years, but in numbers of baseball cities, devastating might be an understatement, especially in places where matters are already dire.
I mean, I'm from Detroit. They just built a stadium there, and the tickets are really expensive, and nobody goes to the games, and the team is losing.
That's a Tigers fan named Nicole, and discouraged as she sounds, a strike still won't kill her affection for the game.
I mean, it's horrible, but I don't know. I would definitely go back just because I like the sport. If they strike, I'm going to be really mad because I won't be able to go to the games. But if they strike and then come back, I'm going to be that moron who does come back because I love it and I care. So that's that.
It would be risky to conclude that the best hope for the players and the owners who've once again pushed matters to the point of a work stoppage is that lots of the fans are morons. But it's a temptation, isn't it?
But Daddy, they ain't playing baseball this year. No pennant races or series to cheer. Money and grease weighs hot dogs and beer. And Daddy, they ain't playing baseball this year. Every Saturday at noon in front of the TV. Right after wrestling on NBC.
It's 18 minutes past the hour. Hunter Scott, a 14-year-old swimmer from Atlanta, recently improved his times dramatically by strapping a flipper to his false leg. Those competing against him claim the flipper works as a, quote, propulsion device and should not be allowed. Scott says he uses the flipper only for balance. The controversy has encouraged all 10 members of the DeKalb Atlanta Swim League's board to resign in fear of lawsuits. Of the flap caused by the flipper, Hunter Scott's mom says, quote, last year when he was losing, it was, oh, your son is so inspirational. This year he started winning, and suddenly people have an issue with his leg.
And I say, oh, oh, oh. The flipper twist is in my soul.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. For complete wrap-up of baseball action and standings in the American and National Leagues, log on to our website, wbur.org, and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Bicon Dental Implants, providing emollient placement to final crown in only 2 patient visits. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Faulkner Hospital, 617-524-3900 or bicon.com. In the forecast, cool with increasing clouds today, highs around 70. A few periods of rain likely late this afternoon into tonight. Periods of fog tonight. Overnight lows near 60. That chance of rain tonight is 80%. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy. A chance of showers through early afternoon. Highs in the mid-70s. Monday, sunny. Highs in the upper 70s. It is 61 degrees in Boston at 720.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, hot times on the football field. But first, at 4 o'clock today, the Carolina Courage and the Washington Freedom will meet to determine the 2002 Women's United Soccer Association champion. You could have gotten long odds with that prediction before the soccer season began. Joining me now to preview the Founders Cup championship game is Wendy Parker, who covers the WUSA for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Wendy, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
The Courage and the Freedom finished at the bottom of the league last season. Neither team made the playoffs. This afternoon they'll play for the championship. How did they improve so dramatically?
Well, that helps when you have the first and second pick in the college draft. In fact, Danielle Slayton, the defender for Carolina, was the first pick in the draft, and she was named the league defensive player of the year. And Washington had the second pick, and they chose a striker named Abby Wambach, who was named the rookie of the year. And they also had some international allocation spots open, and Carolina picked up one of the best players in the world in Birgit Prinz, a German striker who just led her German team to the first Women's European Club Championship. And Washington also picked up her German teammate, Steffi Jones, and both of those players came in the middle of the season, and they have been very instrumental in leading their teams to this game, along with the rookies. So there are a number of changes that both teams made. They kept the core, but in an 18 league, it's not really hard to move up. The parity in the league is a lot stronger this year than it was last year.
Do you see a difference in year two league-wide in the quality of the play?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, there were some games last year that were really kind of hard to watch for sustained periods of time. It was a matter of all the players, you know, becoming familiar with each other and getting accustomed. It's a very physical league. Some of the international players were not used to that, and I think they've all gotten used to that now. And it is a lot stronger. You see more of the back heels and curled, free kicks and corner kicks into the box that you see more in the men's game. There are some more women who are able to do that, and it's a lot more fun to watch.
Atlanta has been perhaps the most consistent team over the first 2 years of the league. The Beat played for the championship last season, and only an overtime goal by Carla Overbeck of Carolina kept Atlanta out of today's game. Are folks in Atlanta disappointed the home team didn't make it, or are they going to show up in great numbers anyway?
Well, I think the league is hoping that they'll show up in great numbers anyway. The stadium holds about 15,000. They've sold anywhere from 10,000 to 12,000. I think a lot of those fans will come out because they've been pretty good fans. And even though they're not going to be in it, it is, being billed as a major sporting event. And we've had a lot of those in Atlanta. And the fact that Carolina is close by, I think they're planning on bringing some fans too. Mm-hmm. But I think the dream matchup might have been to have Atlanta against Washington because that's Mia Hamm's team. But but they still feel really good about being able to get maybe even a sellout, or if not that, then close to one.
Well, last year, I'm sure the league was delighted to have Brandi Chastain in the championship game, and her Cyber Rays won it. The only thing better for the league is, I imagine, having Mia Hamm in the final, and this year she's there. I gather the league probably rooted for that, at least.
Well, I don't know. They'll never say that they did, but certainly the individual stars of the U.S. team in the 1999 Women's World Cup are still, very big drawing cards. Washington's attendance was off a lot this year early in the season when Mia wasn't playing. She didn't join the team until mid-season. certainly she still is one of the biggest drawing cards, and the name recognition, goes beyond women's soccer fans and even soccer fans to all kinds of sports fans. And I think that there will be some more people perhaps paying attention to this game than otherwise there might not have been because she is playing in the game. At least she's not going to be playing in the whole game. She's probably going to be coming off the bench as she has done most of the season.
Carolina finished the regular season on top of the league, but Washington has been the league's hottest team over the past several weeks. Who do you give the edge to this afternoon?
I think that's hard to tell. I mean, Washington has been very, very hot. They've got probably the goalkeeper, the best goalkeeper in the league, in Sarah Mullenix, who did not get goalkeeper of the year. They just played with a lot of confidence. They've just played with a lot of energy. When you win five games in a row coming in and you win some dramatic games the way they have, knowing that you can count on, Mia Hamm to come in for you in the second half and give you a boost has got to be a good factor. But Carolina is a very experienced team. Both teams know from where they were last year to this year, there's so much to be motivated about. And I think it'll be a great game. I think everyone hopes it won't get to penalty kicks. but I think the play is going to be very, very energetic. And it's going to be a hot afternoon down here. But I think that both teams are ready to turn it up as much as they have to win.
Wendy Parker covers the WUSA for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Wendy, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
This afternoon, in the WNBA's Western Conference Finals, the L.A. Sparks will host the Utah Stars. L.A. is up one game to none, having beaten the Stars 75-67 on Thursday evening, in part thanks to the marksmanship of Delisha Milton. The Washington Mystics will try to close out the Eastern Conference Finals in New York this evening. The Mystics, led by Shamiqua Holdsclaw's 20 points, beat the Liberty 79-74 in Game 1 of the best-of-three series on Thursday night in Washington. In the East, at least, it has felt a good deal more like football weather this week than it did last week. Still, the practicing of football in August has long been controversial, uncomfortable, and worse. Only a Game's Karen Given has this story.
He's just one of those kids that had a lot of trouble with training camp. He had trouble with the heat. He had trouble trying to make weight. I think he became overheated more often than people would realize. I think he really suffered with it every time he checked into camp.
It's been just over a year since Minnesota Vikings offensive tackle Corey Stringer died of heat stroke during training camp in Mankato, Minnesota. This year, when players arrived at camp, they found canopies for shade, a cooler cafeteria, and lighter-colored jerseys to wear on sunny days. Vikings center Matt Burke noticed the changes.
Water, there seemed to be more water out there. I mean, almost, excessive, almost to a point. And then the canopies they put out there are nice. And then when you get 5 minutes in the shade, it really really does seem to make a difference. I didn't think it would, but, as a player, I've come to appreciate it.
Vikings officials won't talk about the improvements due to a $100 million lawsuit filed by Stringer's widow. But in a written statement, the team insists last year's training camp was safe and changes were made as part of an ongoing effort to improve. Stringer wasn't the only football player to die of heat stroke last summer. During the same week, Erosti Otten, a college player in Florida, and Travis Stowers, a high school player in Indiana, also died. Heatstroke deaths in football have doubled in the past 10 years, according to a study by the University of North Carolina. Professor Fred Mueller says his study can't explain the increase, but a number of factors could be involved, including bigger players, use of supplements like ephedra, and one modern convenience we take for granted.
Many of these players, especially young players, don't spend any time in the warm weather. They're always in an air-conditioned house during the day. They sleep in an air-conditioned house. They go in an air-conditioned car. They're in air-conditioning classrooms. And so they're really not being acclimatized to the heat.
At the Arizona Cardinals' high-altitude training camp in Flagstaff earlier this month, heat wasn't an issue. But head athletic trainer John Amahandro says that the team, whether in the cool mountains around Flagstaff or in the sun and heat at their regular training facility outside Phoenix, pays attention to the risks.
We're extremely attuned to the fact that it is hot. And the players need to be well hydrated. The coach goes a lot in shorts rather than full gear. We practice out of direct sunlight. We try and encourage them to take their helmet off and let the air get to their head and stuff between plays. There's just a lot of different things that are done. We've had just zero problems. I would say that we're one of the few teams that have never given an IV probably in the last 2 years.
Before last week, Northeastern University head coach Don Brown might have been able to say the same thing. But two-a-day practices during a record-setting heat wave hit the team hard.
I've been coaching for 26 years. It's the hottest period or stretch I've ever been through in terms of preseason. And with us having the Astro play surface, you can count on it's 10 degrees warmer than on grass. We actually had four players that we sent to get IVs, probably didn't need them, but we were proactive. Just a scenario when you're going in doubles and it's, 110 on average on the field, you really have to pay attention to player safety. And you're trying to get better as a football team, but at the same time, you got a kind of a twofold scenario that you got to be, pay attention to.
During the heat wave, Northeastern went through about 800 gallons of water during every two-hour session. All conditioning drills were performed without helmets and pads, and practices were moved to cooler parts of the day. Even though the thermostat has now dipped about 20 degrees cooler, Northeastern still has an army of trainers and water carriers on hand, making sure the team stays hydrated. But Kim Terrell, Northeastern's head athletic trainer, says water isn't the only thing she's worried about.
The biggest thing that we get concerned about is if they are using supplements like stimulants that are advertised as being very, very safe, which in very hot conditions and intense exercise, they're really not safe at all. And a lot of the people who've had serious heat problems have been using those supplements. So being able to use that as an education tool, get them off of those products, has been really helpful. And now that they're aware, they have to make the effort to hydrate after practices, during the meetings, and they all do that.
When the call goes out for a break, more than a dozen players storm the water station. They gulp down large cups of water or sports drink and then quickly make their way back to the field.
Let's go, let's go!
Northeastern captain Steve Anzalone says this summer players are much more aware of heat risks. After Corey Stringer's death, reports suggested that Vikings players had noticed Stringer was in trouble, but hadn't said anything for fear of hurting Stringer's career. Anzalone says that wouldn't happen on his team.
If I see a teammate who's really hurting like that, you know, I'll say something, tell a trainer or something like that to help him out. So, you know, I don't want to see anything like that happen. You know, that's a terrible tragedy, and hopefully we can prevent something like that happening if anybody ever comes even close to something like that.
It's early on Wednesday morning, and high school players from Brookline, Massachusetts, sit under the shade of a large tree while they wait for their first outdoor practice of the season to begin. Although their training camp began after the end of the heat wave, these players take every opportunity to enjoy the shade. But while Northeastern's Don Brown is glad the heat wave is over, Brookline High's head coach, Malcolm Cawthorn, is a little disappointed he missed it.
You know, actually, I would kind of rather it be hot in the sense that, you know, kids get the feeling of accomplishment if they can live and survive a camp that's super hot. They feel like anything else in front of them is cake. So I actually probably would have enjoyed a nice hot few practices. But, you know, it's nice this way. I mean, they're still going to get a good workout. They'll still, you know, get themselves in condition. But, you know, you come with what comes. And if it's 90, great. If it's not, you know, great. That's great, too.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon.
Following unanimous vote by the members of the Devils Lake, North Dakota School Board on Monday night, the athletes from the high school in Devils Lake will no longer be known as the Satans. Joining me now from Devils Lake, actually from his pickup truck, is Kevin Reagan, president of the Devils Lake School Board. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I understand that this nickname, the Satans, has been a source of some controversy for 25 years. Why did it finally get dumped, and why did it take so long for that to happen?
I think that in the politically correct environment that we live in and the fact that people in the area are getting kind of sick of dealing with it, that it was the right time.
Well, it's interesting that you mention the phrase politically correct, because most of the time when a school drops a nickname or a mascot, it's because the name is deemed offensive to Native Americans. But I gather the problem wasn't worry about offending the devil or his minions or something.
Yeah, I've heard that point of view as well. Yeah, I guess the majority of the offensive nature of the name, as you might suspect, it comes from the religious people in the area. No specific religion, I guess, but just the people that deem it offensive.
How do student-athletes and students in general at Devils Lake High School feel about the change?
Well, I don't think they're as entrenched as they have been in previous years when this has come up, but generally speaking, over the years when this has come up, the students have always been in favor of keeping the name as is.
They liked being the Satans.
Yeah.
All right. Well, obviously, this development means that you've got to come up with a new nickname. What's the process for that?
Well, we've been discussing that somewhat, and the process that we're going to use, I believe, is going to be something along the idea of getting the student council together, have the student council take names from all the high school classmates, and also we'll have a community input suggestion box, if you will, and letter area where they can write letters to and make suggestions. And I'll have the students narrow it down to maybe three or four, and then have them vote on that, and then the school board will ultimately be the final decider. But I would guess that if something that is overwhelmingly one or the other, the school board would adopt that.
Well, that sounds like a very democratic process, and I think it's fine, but I hope you guys don't come up with something hackneyed like the Tigers, the Hawks, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I was kind of thinking something along the line of the Fluffy Cottontails, but...
That would be about as far from the Satans as you could get, I guess.
Yeah, right. We've had all kinds of water problems in this area over the last few years. We have a lake, Devil's Lake, that has risen, somewhere around 30 feet over the last 10 years, and we have all kinds of road work and dikes and everything put around the lake, so we've had a lot of suggestions concerning the name being named after something with the flood situation, like the Devil's Lake Flood or the Devil's Lake Dikes or the Devil's Lake.
I think you want to stay away from Devil's Lake Dikes.
Yeah, we also talked about that. But there's a lot of half-hearted suggestions in that respect.
Kevin Reagan is the president of the Devil's Lake School Board. Thank you very much for speaking with me, and good luck.
Okay, thank you very much.
Nice to meet you. Hope you get my name. And you is the nature of my name. Oh, yeah. Get down in it.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at Nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Feynman Remodeling of Arlington, striving to create satisfied clients through innovations in architectural design, craft, and management. 781-643-6269. Good morning, I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, Pedro Martinez pitched 8 solid innings for his 17th win of the season. As the Red Sox beat the Angels 4-1 last night, the two teams play again this afternoon at Fenway. The Worcester All-Stars play Louisville, Kentucky tonight for the U.S. Finals of the Little League World Series. The winner of tonight's game will play Japan or Curacao in tomorrow's World Championship. Tom Brady threw his first touchdown passes of the exhibition season last night at Gillette Stadium as the New England Patriots beat Carolina 23-3. And the New England Revolution are on the road tonight. They play in Chicago. Check out the public radio store at WBUR.org. This weekend, any purchase of a new laptop computer will get you a $100 gift certificate, good at Amazon.com. The public radio store at WBUR.org, where every purchase helps pay for the news. Cool with increasing clouds today, highs around 70, a few periods of rain likely late today and tonight, overnight lows near 60. It's 739, 61 degrees in Boston.
WBUR and New England Toyota dealers are giving you a chance to commute to work in a super low emissions vehicle and support the news. Your $100 pledge by September 6th will enter your name into a drawing to win a gasoline electric hybrid car, a four-door 2002 Toyota Prius. Take this chance at helping the environment while supporting the news. Enter the drawing and learn more at WBUR.org or pledge now with a call to 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of a very long marathon run over a very short course. But first, I'm joined by our analyst, Charlie Pierce, for a discussion of the week's sports news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Baseball negotiations this week have seemed to follow something of a John and Marcia soap opera storyline. One day everybody's happy, the next day nobody's happy. The strike deadline, now a mere 6 days away. Has your prognostication changed at all since last week?
Gee, I don't know. What was my prognostication last week? Fill me in.
I think it has something to do with brimstone.
No. A strike and a brief one. I'm actually more optimistic than that. I think there may not be a strike. I think the question now is whether or not management will accept a quarter or half a victory in order to keep the sport going. There's been movement on every issue they're upset about, and all the movement has been in their direction. There was also an agreement this week to modify what is known as the 60-40 rule, the details of which I will bore neither you nor our audience.
I appreciate that.
But that also eased the union's fears about another kind of backdoor drag on salaries. I think there are enough owners who understand that shutting the sport down is a bad idea. And I think there are enough owners that understand that they're getting some of what they want, that they may force a deal at the 11th hour.
You officially struck the Heisman pose last week. Oh, here it is again. But today, a few powerhouses will be in action. Who watches these late August matchups? I'm not even sure the students are back on campus for these yet.
Well, gamblers.
Ask a stupid question.
No, seriously, though, this is a time of year between now and the middle of September where your entire season can go up the chute. If Arizona State goes in and beats Nebraska tonight, Nebraska's season already has one tire blown out on it. For years and years, when Tennessee and Florida would play while Peyton Manning was there and Tennessee would lose to Florida, that would be the end of their chance for a national championship. So while we do scoff and we do admit that it's ridiculously early to be playing college football, some of these games really count.
On Thursday, the World Basketball Championships began with a 30-point drubbing of China at the hands of the U.S. This was an exhibition game. The tournament begins for real next Thursday in Indianapolis. A roster of NBA players will compete on behalf of the U.S., but it's not exactly an NBA All-Star team, is it?
No, it's not. It's the sort of the Love Boat cast of the NBA. It's the Bob Cummings and Bernie Coppels of the NBA. But, of course, the biggest attraction is that Yao Ming, the first pick in the draft, is here playing for China. He was 5 for 12. The Americans shoved him around a little bit in his first game. He impressed several of the Americans. But there's no question that this world championship, if there's any interest in it at all, it's to see how he plays against the rest of the world.
The NBA took yet another step toward world domination this week, Charlie. Telemundo, the Spanish-language television network, will be televising NBA and WNBA games over the next three seasons. ¿Qué bueno, verdad?
Well, I have to admit, as a former Televisa employee, because it was Televisa who owns Telemundo, who owned the late lamented National, which had its unfortunate accident while docking at Lakehurst, New Jersey 11 years ago, I'm very, very excited about my former employees getting the NBA. And, you know, it's the sport that's selling the world.
My own hope, of course, is that this will give us the opportunity to hear the estimable Andres Cantor scream, "Field goal!"
82 times a game. It will be kind of anticlimactic if he does it for three throws, though, you have to admit.
Four teams remain in the WNBA playoffs. The Washington Mystics and the L.A. Sparks each hold a one-game lead in their best-of-three series against, respectively, the New York Liberty and the Utah Stars. Do we see a new champion this year?
That would be the Utah Stars, but perhaps. But what we do see in the East Coast end of the proceedings is a chance for me, finally, in her WNBA career, to say the name of Shamiqua Holtzclaw.
Yes, we may indeed be saying it.
I think it would be very good for the league. She's one of the highest profile players they have. I think it would be very good for the league if the Washington Mystics were to win the championship.
Help me with the logic of this next story, Charlie. A guy can earn a salary playing pro baseball and still be eligible to play college basketball. But another guy, in this case Jeremy Bloom of the University of Colorado, can't do endorsements as a pro skier and still play college football. How does the NCAA come up with this one?
Dude, it's the NCAA, dude.
Another stupid question.
Where do you go with this? I mean, this is the kind of foolishness that these people sit around and have meetings about. I'll tell you the truth. I have to give Jeremy Bloom a lot of credit. He's a world-class mogul skier, which means that he makes all his money on endorsements pretty much. He wants to be a wide receiver. He's apparently a very talented football player. But on November 29th, even if he doesn't play, he's going to go to Lincoln, Nebraska with the football team and be on the sidelines. He's going to be on the sidelines when they play Colorado State on August 31st. And God love him for it. I hope at the very, very least he can embarrass the NCAA into just hoping this thing will go away. He'll get to keep his endorsement money, and he'll get to play. I mean, this is just a towering embarrassment.
Is the NCAA's logic any sounder regarding their endorsement this month of a so-called, quote, out-of-season football conditioning model?
Well, it's a fig leaf. It's a good one. I hope it's an effective one. It's a way to try to have some control over what coaches do in the offseason with their players and to their players. Unfortunately, it's once again drowning in bureaucraties. We're talking about student-athlete discretionary time. When I was a college student, I considered all my time discretionary time. The NCAA is sort of categorizing it in a different way. But any effort to control what coaches do with their players and to their players, I think, is all to the good.
Under the category of choose your victims carefully, we find the story of Tyrone Germaine Hogan, who on Tuesday allegedly tried to carjack a minivan full of judo experts, an adventure that went about as you would predict, I suppose.
Oh! Christina Baldacci, one of the teammates, was very disappointed as she told the local news people, the boys were punching him in the face and I wanted to go around for a choke to choke him out, but I didn't want to risk getting punched in the head, so I started pounding him from the back. Good Lord. Apparently they were in town to teach a self-defense class and they had taken a tour of Hollywood and they stopped for gas and along comes the world's dumbest criminal and tries to steal their van.
Sending this guy to jail would be superfluous.
Well,
right?
No. Well, I think handing him over to the LAPD was probably superfluous.
Finally, Charlie, in this week's dumbest attempt to cheat at sports, a Canadian gentleman who tried to win the Great Ontario Salmon Hunt by stuffing 7 pounds of lead pipe into the salmon which he had caught. I guess the only dumber thing would be to try to eat the fish after he'd stuffed it.
Contacted at its home, the salmon was quoted as saying, "Woo!"
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe, Sunday Magazine, and for Esquire Magazine. He also regularly reels them in for only a game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, eh?
Because fish makes you smart, and beans make you, and eating red meat is bad for your heart, so take it from me.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org.
Because fish makes you smart and beans make you...
From mid-June to early August, a half-dozen members of the Sri Chinmoy Marathon team competed in a one-of-a-kind endurance race, one that tested their spiritual and physical strength. Dave Ungrady witnessed this annual ultra-distance race, and he has this report.
On a late afternoon in early August, following a week of oppressive heat, the cozy streets of central Queens come alive. Soccer balls and basketballs bounce and roll into view. And there's a lone runner in the distance, struggling to stay on her feet. Super Bebectred has 6 miles remaining in a race which has, so far, brought her over 3,000 miles. To help her finish, she focuses on inner strength.
We have the traffic and the kids on bikes and the concrete sidewalk and everything, but somehow your meditation can take you inside where you have all kind of beautiful things that you can kind of bring forward, you know, things that will help you. If you can go inside... and kind of bring forward your childlike consciousness, then you can really conquer a lot of difficulties.
Difficulties like finishing the final 12 half-mile laps of the 3,100-mile-long Sri Chinmoy Self-Transcendence Race. Bechtard and 5 other runners started the world's longest certified foot race on June 16th. To finish, they need to average at least 60 miles each day. The half-mile course encircles the Thomas Jefferson Vocational Technical High School in Queens. Runners are required to begin racing at 6 a.m. and can stay on the course up until midnight. German Wolfgang Schwerk, whose spiritual name is Madhupran, explains the mindset needed to finish all 3,100 miles of the race.
I think only the day. When I'm starting, I think you must be running 70 miles or more. And I concentrate on this point, and all the day I push to this point and hold my energy very high with no sleeping and making no great breaks, only changing shoes and socks, but all the time running.
All six runners are members of the Sri Chinmoy Marathon team. The group, which organizes several ultra-distance races each year, says running helps them grow spiritually. Race director Bipin Larkin is also a team member.
Sri Chinmoy, I mean, feels that in each individual is a capacity beyond what they recognize, okay? It's certainly not unique to his philosophy. It's you know, throughout the world, a lot of people feel that. And we've dedicated ourselves to trying to realize that, trying to express that spiritually, physically, and using running as a metaphor for our spiritual lives.
71-year-old Sri Chinmoy was a top athlete as a youth. He started running marathons in the 1970s. The spiritual leader claims to have lifted more than 7,000 pounds in one motion over his head. That and other physical feats have compelled many worldwide to follow his creed. Among those is former Olympic track champion Carl Lewis, who wrote in his latest book that Sri Chinmoy helped inspire him to his final gold medal at the 1996 Summer Olympics. The challenges in the Sri Chinmoy 3,100-mile transcendence race are numerous. Competitors eat food from cups while walking. Some sleep as little as 4 hours a day. They endure swollen knees and numerous blisters. In past races, a dog bit one runner, and another fell after colliding with a homeless man walking out of a bush. Superba Bechtert is able to run this year despite shoulder problems, which cause her to lean one way and then another. Bechtert continued running with the help of chiropractic treatment. A few miles from the end, she explains another concern.
I don't feel any pain right now, but I have, along with my tilting, my feet have a tendency to trip each other. So I actually have to be pretty careful at this stage in the race.
Aspri Hatel-Alto of Finland has won the Transcendence race twice. He says it's easy to doubt oneself once the race is underway.
First time I ran it, it was somehow easy, like enthusiasm, first time in my life I'm doing this thing. So it, in a way it was easy. Then the second time I get chin splints right from the beginning, and mind problems, inspiration problems, why on earth am I going to do this? 50 days of pain, what is this?
Did it ever get to the point where it felt so difficult that you were going to stop?
This year and the first year, no. But last year, in the beginning, I was really thinking of it. But I'm always like, aura that I don't want to think of such thing at all. It's just not an option. It's not an option to stop. So you just go on and go. If you have troubles, then you go through it. And then there will come a day when it's easy again. So...
To help ease Bechtert as she prepares to run the last few miles, 12-year-old Lalita Frigowa of Austria sits near the finish line and plays melodies on her violin.
I hope that I can inspire her running more, playing fast songs. It inspires me to never give up. Like, if you have a dream of something, that you should never stop training for it or doing something like this.
As Bechtert begins her last lap, two other women standing near the finish sing a tribute. By 6 p.m. on August 6th, Bechtert completes the race and is greeted by race director Sahishnu Seshal.
Superba, you finished 3,100 miles for the sixth time. In a time of 51 days, 12 hours, 8 minutes, and 6 seconds, which is your third fastest of all six. Congratulations. I'd just like to say that Superba is the only person to ever do it more than 4 times, and she's the only woman to ever do it. She has every record for long distance beyond 1,300 miles all the way up to 5,000 kilometers. And this is another remarkable performance.
Aalto finishes second this year in 46 days, 13 hours, and 27 minutes. The winner, Schwerk, finishes in 42 days, 13 hours, 24 minutes, a new record by more than 4 days. Schwerk averaged more than 72 miles a day. Even though Superba Vectored comes in last, this is her day. About 50 onlookers, including the other finishers, break out into song. I asked Vectored if, after finishing an ultra-distance race, she thinks about running longer races.
That's something I really don't want to think about.
Vectored plans to stay in New York for a few weeks to help celebrate Sri Chinmoy's 72nd birthday. Vectored says next year's race will likely be her last Transcendence run. She plans to start training in February. For Only a Game, I'm Dave Ungrady in Queens, New York.
Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. We had help this week from Glenn Alexander, Doug Shugarts, Matt Lieber, Greg Eklund, Simone Steverson, and Mitch Eaton at NPR in Washington, as well as Sadie Babbitts and Mitch Tyke at member station KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, sign up for our newsletter, or witness a football practice without the heat, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from the Only a Game staff, who wish to congratulate me on the completion of our 468th program.
Bill is a world-class radio host. He reports, he retorts. Victory banner! Yeah!
Apologies to marathoners, transcendentalists, heck, radio listeners everywhere. That was embarrassing. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WB...
Public Radio.
This is WB...